So I have a question about yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
See, in the beginning, you said that the thermal freeze-out mechanism is not the only mechanism for producing dark matter.
Yes.
And then you went off to kind of show that we did MSSM, the LSP could be a good candidate for the dark matter particle. And then after that, the two special cases. So what I'm trying to understand is you didn't really cover the
Because I didn't get to that. So
okay, I just want to make that sure that.
So I didn't get to everything I meant to get to yesterday.
Okay.
So I'm actually going to cover non-thermal dark matter production.
Okay.
So everything I spoke about yesterday was
thermal
dark matter, specifically for the MSSM.
Right.
Specifically for the MSSM, and also highlighting the special cases.
Right.
So the special cases don't always apply, but sometimes they can be important.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's precisely what I'm going to cover today. Non-thermal dark matter. And the source of the term non-thermal is that if you think about thermal freeze-out, the starting point is the hot soup of elementary particles, where the dark matter particle is in equilibrium with that soup. So the dark matter species is part of that hot soup of elementary particles in some sort of thermodynamic equilibrium. The idea for non-thermal dark matter, though, is that the dark matter was either never in thermal equilibrium with the bath, or the way that you produce it is different from just this simple freeze-out mechanism. So there are lots of different ways this can happen. So I'm just going to highlight a few. And to actually start off, I'm going to continue with the supersymmetry theme. And supersymmetry, or SUSY for short, it turns out that supersymmetry is, I don't know if this was covered in your BSM course, supersymmetry, if you like, is an extension of the Poincaré symmetries of special relativity. So the Poincaré symmetry is a flat space-time. And in this sense, the Poincaré symmetries are global symmetries. And supersymmetry, as we've encountered it, is a global symmetry as well. Now, to go from flat space to curved space and special relativity to general relativity, one way to think about this is you take your Poincaré symmetries and you make them into, you generalize them to local coordinate transformations. So you generalize your Poincaré symmetries to a local symmetry, so a local gauge symmetry. And that gives you GR. And you can do a similar extension of GR in the sense that supersymmetry is an extension of Poincaré. The corresponding extension of supersymmetry, where you elevate supersymmetry to a local spacetime symmetry, is called supergravity, or sometimes people write it as supra. So supergravity, supergravity can get very complicated, and I'm not going to get into the whole thing, but I do want to mention one aspect of supergravity that can be relevant for dark matter, and that is that, if you recall, in supersymmetry, every particle we had around had a superpartner. In supergravity, you necessarily have an additional particle in the form of the graviton. And in supergravity, you extend the graviton to, how do I want to write it? I'll write it this way, to a gravitino. So the graviton, in a sense, corresponds to spin 2. The gravitino differs by spin in half a unit. It corresponds, in a sense, to spin 3 halves. And the way I'm writing the gravitino is a common way. The spin 3 halves field is often written as a fermion carrying a vector index. Some of the components of this object are redundant, in the same way that some of the components of the graviton, which you'll often write as a two-index symmetric tensor, are also redundant. But I'm just going to write it this way. So in the limit of exact supersymmetry, in the context of supergravity, the gravitino is massless. And this is just what we'd expect, in that the graviton's massless, and the gravitino should have the same mass as a superpartner in the supersymmetric limit. However, we know that we have to break supersymmetry. And when you break supersymmetry, the gravitino picks up a mass. And a slightly funny thing happens. I'll just mention this in passing. When you break supersymmetry spontaneously, supersymmetry is a symmetry with fermionic symmetry generators. And when you break supersymmetry spontaneously, you get the supersymmetric equivalent of a Goldstone boson, which is called a Goldstino, which is a massless fermion corresponding to the spontaneously broken symmetry. In the case of spontaneously breaking supergravity, instead of getting a massless Goldstino, the massless Goldstino is actually eaten by the gravitino to make a massless spin 3 half state. And just as the extra scalar degree of freedom gives you the extra polarization for a massive vector, the extra fermionic degree of freedom for the Goldstino gives you the additional degrees of freedom you need to make a massive gravitino. But in any case, we can characterize supersymmetry breaking by a quantity called F. And this applies for both local and global symmetry. So supersymmetry breaking, you characterize it by a quantity called F with mass dimension 2. So as units of, let's say, GeV squared. And in terms of this F, the gravitino mass, which is usually written as m3 halves, is given roughly by F over m Planck. And remember that I'm using a normalization where my Planck mass is the reduced value, 2.4 times 10 to the 18 GeV. So this quantity, this m3 halves, is units of mass. F is the quantity that characterizes supersymmetry breaking.
Okay.
So
the F term.
Yeah. So F equals zero implies that supersymmetry is unbroken, and F non-zero means that you break supersymmetry. So this relation is F over M Planck is universal. Whenever you break supersymmetry characterized by an F term, this is what you get for your gravitino mass. On the other hand, the thing we're usually interested in are the soft masses of the standard model superpartners, because these are the things that couple in a much stronger way to the stuff we see. So the typical soft mass for the MSSM, so I'll write it this way, actually depends on how you communicate supersymmetry breaking to the standard model. In the sense that our generic picture of supersymmetry breaking is that you have supersymmetry breaking off in some hidden sector, and then there is some communicator that branches between the supersymmetry breaking sector and the MSSM sector. And this communicator sector has a typical mass called, they'll call MS, where MS stands for messenger. And it turns out that M soft, the soft masses in the MSSM, go like F over MS, M of MS.
Sorry, what does soft mean?
Good question. So did you discuss, I guess in your BSM course, did you go over supersymmetry breaking at all?
We did, just
a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I mean by soft is that every operator, every coupling that breaks supersymmetry in your theory comes with a positive mass dimension. And the reason that's good is that if I look at my theory at energies much, much larger than all of these soft terms, which all carry a positive mass dimension, my theory looks supersymmetric. So in that sense, because all the supersymmetry breaking comes in with a positive mass dimension, it goes away effectively at high energies. And my high energy theory looks supersymmetric.
So strictly positive, not zero.
Strictly positive. Whereas if I had some dimensionless coupling, that dimensionless coupling would still hang around at all energies, up to renormalization effects. So for example, every single operator in the MSSM that breaks supersymmetry comes along with some mass dimension. So it's either a direct mass term for the fields or a trilinear coupling between three scalars that comes with a positive mass dimension. But the whole point about soft is soft just means that the symmetry is more or less restored at high energies. Okay, so there are different ways to communicate supersymmetry breaking. And the two most popular ones, I'll just give you a list of examples. One of the popular ways is the messenger scale is the Planck scale, and this is called gravity mediation. And the other case is I can have something called gauge mediation. And the idea of gauge mediation is the messengers, in this case, are some fields that carry standard model gauge charges. And these messenger fields in gauge mediation couple both directly to supersymmetry breaking, but they carry standard model gauge charges as well. And through those gauge interactions, they communicate supersymmetry breaking to the MSSM. But these details don't matter too much, except for the fact that what I want to point out is that in gravity mediation, the gravitational mass is about the same as the MSSM soft masses. Whereas in gauge mediation, the gravitational mass is typically much, much less in the MSSM soft masses. So this is actually very important for dark matter. Because, in gravity mediation, your lightest MSSM superpartner can be the lightest of all the superpartners, and be the stable LSP. Whereas in gauge mediation, or variations on it. The LSP is usually the gravitational. And this can actually mess up the dark matter story. Because what happens in this case is that you'll have the usual thermal freeze-out of your dark matter to your lightest standard model superpartner. And that standard model superpartner will then decay at some later time to the gravitational. And if your gravitational is too light, you don't get enough dark matter. But there is sort of an intermediate case, which corresponds to gauge mediation with a very, very large M star approaching the Planck scale. So the first example of non-thermal dark matter I want to tell you about, and this is related to all this gravitational business, this is related to this gravitational business, is called SuperWIMP. Dark matter. And the idea of SuperWIMP dark matter is that your spectrum looks like this. You have your MSSM LSP plus possibly some higher superpartners, and then you have some lighter gravitational, and then typically your standard model stuff is even lighter still. And the SuperWIMP idea is that your MSSM LSP freezes out just in the usual way. And I'll call the MSSM LSP Chi. But it, in principle, it could be any of the standard model superconductors. And then Chi then later decays to the gravitino plus a standard model state. And Psi is now the dark matter. So this is sort of a semi-non-thermal mechanism for getting dark matter, in that in the first step, I do have a thermal freeze-out. In the second step, my would-be LSP decays into the gravitino plus some standard model state, and it's this gravitino that's now the dark matter. And in this case, I can estimate the dark matter relic density. The dark matter relic density, well, because each superpartner decay produces one gravitino, that means that the number density of gravitinos is going to be equal to what the number density of my chi would have been had it not decayed. But on the other hand, the energy density, and that's what goes into this omega h squared, is the mass of the particle times the number density today. So what I get is what I get for my relic density in the superwimp scenario of gravitinos is I get the relic density I would have had if chi had been stable. But I have to rescale it by the ratio of the masses. Yeah.
So why does the gravitino not freeze out?
So I skipped over that. Okay. So here I implicitly assumed that my initial gravitino density was very small. And actually, I'll say a little bit more about that in the next few minutes.
Okay.
But for now, I'm going to assume that the sort of primordial gravitino abundance is effectively zero. So the idea of superwimp dark matter is this. And it's a little bit depressing in that gravitinos interact very, very weakly. And I'll get into this in a second. So gravitinos interact very, very weakly. And because they do, even though the dark matter is produced in a freeze-out mechanism, the usual direct detection and indirect detection signals of dark matter don't come through here. So it's a bit of a problem. On the other hand, there is an indirect way to probe this. And that is this decay happens pretty late in the evolution of the universe. And one of the things it can do, and one of the things that really constrains this scenario, is that this decay can mess up the light element abundances produced in nucleosynthesis. So the idea is that when this decay happens, the standard model particle comes out really fast. And this high-energy standard model particle emitted in the decay can start to break up the light nuclei it created during nucleosynthesis. So for example, one of the possible signatures of this are that your predictions for nucleosynthesis don't match what you observe. This is nice in principle. In practice, it's actually very hard. There are lots of uncertainties involved with predicting nucleosynthesis and also measuring the abundances of light elements. So in practice, this is very difficult. But in principle, you could get at this scenario that way. So this is the idea of superwimp. I have usual freeze-out, and then I produce gravitinos. But a second example is direct gravitino dark matter. And the second example doesn't have to involve thermal freeze-out at all. In the second example, we actually look at the direct interactions of the gravitino itself. And these interactions, I'm probably going to mess up writing these down, but these interactions, to get at these interactions, I want to look at the effect of gravitino couplings. And the gravitino couplings with this, couple with a strength given by 1 over the Planck mass. And the coupling to, let's say, a standard model fermion is given by, I think I'm probably going to mess this up, but mu, I think this is gamma mu, del nu, tilde. Okay, don't quote me on this coupling. But the important parts of it are that it involves a gravitino coupling to a fermion and a superpartner's fermion, and the strength of the coupling was like 1/N. So, because the interaction is so weak, that means that typically, if I look at gravitinos. As long as the gravitinos are fairly heavy, they don't fall. They never achieve thermodynamic equilibrium. So if I look at the rate of this process, this rate is typically too slow for the gravitino to equilibrate with the plasma in the early universe, unless the temperature of the universe was once around the Planck scale. And in most situations, we don't expect this to happen, at least not after inflation. Okay, so there's one caveat to this. There's one warning I want to give you about this, and that this statement is not always true. And the reason the statement isn't always true is that this massive gravitino actually contains within it a longitudinal mode coming from the Goldsteino. And this Goldsteino actually couples more strongly than the gravitino. The longitudinal Goldsteino component actually couples a bit more strongly than 1/N to stuff. And the way that comes about is that if I look at a gravitino in the external state, I get a polarization sum. And if you remember polarization sums for massive vectors, those massive vector polarization sums have stuff that goes like eta mu nu plus p mu over, let's say, mw squared in the case of a w. And for processes where my momenta are very large compared to the W mass, this piece can actually give me an enhancement. And this is the enhancement corresponding to coupling to the longitudinal mode. And this enhancement actually turns out to be equivalent to coupling to the scalar component of the massive vector. In the same way, if I couple to the gravitino, If I couple to the gravitino, because I have a Goldsteino component, the effect of the Goldsteino component means that I should go off. I should calculate with this interaction, and after I've calculated with that interaction, the effect of summing over gravitino polarizations is going to give me a factor typically of the form 1 plus m soft m soft squared over m 3/2 squared. And this factor multiplies the squared matrix element. So I'm just mentioning this in passing. I'm going to concentrate on the situation where the gravitino is fairly heavy. So that this factor is order 1. But I do want to mention that if I have a very light gravitino, I get effectively much larger couplings, and this statement isn't quite true. But for me, I'm going to concentrate on the case where this factor is roughly 1. And if this factor is about 1, this statement is true. So that means that I never actually equilibrate my gravitino with a thermal bath. So I'm never going to have a freeze-out process. So this makes it a bit harder to get the dark matter. But even though I never equilibrate, that doesn't mean I can't produce gravitinos in the early universe. Because, for example, I do expect to have fermions and spermions in my thermal bath. And I could have processes. Let me think of a process I could have. So I could have a gluon coupling to a standard volatile quark, and the standard volatile quark will go in the S channel, and now I couple through this interaction to the gravitino, and I could produce a gravitino this way. So this kind of scattering process in the early universe can create gravitinos. On the other hand, once I've created a gravitino, it basically doesn't interact with anything. Now, the rate for this interaction, assuming my gravitinos are fairly heavy, is never going to be big enough for the gravitino to reach the full thermal density. But I can still produce a gravitino density in this way. And the upshot of this, and let me just find my notes for it, the upshot for this is that if I look at these processes and all kinds of other processes, what I get for my gravitino interaction from this kind of process is the contribution to the gravitino density from this spore scattering process is roughly 1/2 times alpha 3 times T max over 10 to the 10 GeV m3/2 over 100 GeV times a 1 plus So what I mean by this T max is the maximal temperature the universe attained while it was radiation dominated. And I guess you guys covered inflation a little bit in your previous courses?
In the cosmology.
In the cosmology course. So this T max is actually the same thing as what you call T reheat. Effectively the reheating temperature after inflation. So in this case, you have a completely non-thermal production mechanism for dark matter. And the production mechanism, well, the way I produce dark matter, my gravitino is never in thermodynamic equilibrium. But because I have these residual forward scattering processes, I still produce some gravitinos. And these gravitinos make up some fraction of dark matter.
And they don't decay shortly afterwards?
My assumption here is that the gravitino is the LSP. I assume that implicitly. If the gravitino is not the LSP, it's going to decay into the standard model stuff precisely through this kind of interaction. But the decay tends to be a bit slow. But it's still fast enough that the gravitino can't be the dark matter unless it's the LSP.
case.
So actually, what I really should have done is that, in general, I have both of these contributions to the dark matter density if I have a gravitational LSP. So this is one contribution. So to say there's one contribution, I'll put a delta here. And I'm also going to have the super Wimp contribution here. So my total gravitational relative density will be the sum of this non-thermal, this completely non-thermal mechanism plus the super Wimp mechanism.
In this formula, alpha 3 is the coupling constant for CCD?
Yeah.
And what value are we taking?
Yeah, so it's a QCD coupling. I don't know, can you guys see past the... Okay. So I'll write it over here. Sorry for all the boxes. So alpha 3 is the QCD coupling. Or put another way, it's g3 squared over 4 pi, in the same way that alpha is e squared over 4 pi for electromagnetism. And if you recall, gauge couplings run with energy. So gauge couplings are energy dependent. And it's also the value, the running value, evaluated at the scale Tmax. So it's going to be a little bit less than the value we measure at low energies, because the coupling decreases as they go up in energy. Okay. So this is one example of, this is another case of non-thermal dark matter. Another popular example is dark matter from the decays of heavy states. So this will be my third example. My third example is dark matter from heavy particle decay. So this dark matter from heavy particle decay is actually very similar to dark matter you would get from the decay of an inflaton field after inflation. So a lot of stuff I'm going to say here also transfers over to the reheating process after inflation. So the idea here is suppose we have some particle P that's very heavy. And that has a long lifetime. What can happen in this case is that if I start off with, if this particle starts off with a large density, perhaps this heavy particle underwent some kind of thermal freeze out very, very early in the evolution of the universe. This heavy particle, through its density, can come to dominate the energy density of the universe. So I'm going to look at the case where in writing. I'm going to look at the case where P becomes the dominant contribution to rho, to the energy density of the universe. So the idea here is that I have a very heavy particle. The heavy particle freezes out very early. And if you like, while the dark matter, before the dark matter decays, before this particle decays, it acts like dark matter, but very early on. And it comes to dominate the energy density of the universe. And when that happens, the radiation in the universe dilutes away just through the expansion. But later on, when this particle decays, it's going to decay into radiation and reheat the universe. So the picture, if I look at the energy density of the universe, is that I start off being radiation dominated. So I'll plot rho as well as rho radiation. I start off being radiation dominated, and then I become matter dominated as P takes over. But while P is taking over, two things are happening. So that's radiation domination. Here's P domination. And while P is dominant, the radiation keeps on falling from dilution. But at the same time, P starts to decay. And when P starts to decay, it contributes to the radiation as well. And when P starts to decay, there's a second contribution to the radiation. It comes out this way. And eventually, P decays away. Eventually, the P density decays away. And I go back to a radiation-dominated case. So here, P is dominating. Here, radiation is dominating. Actually, let me get the color chalk, because I think that will make things a bit more clear. So in red, I'm going to draw the radiation density. So the radiation density looks like that. And the P density, the density of P, is going to look like that. And the total energy density is, I've got more colors here. The total energy density is just the sum of the P density and the radiation density.
So that's a logarithmic plot.
Yes. So I'm implicitly using logarithmic axes. Otherwise, I'd have to use a whole board. I get crazy. Okay. So, but yeah, it's a log plot. But the story that happens is that I start off being radiation dominated. This P density becomes important, and the P density is important until the P decays away, and this decay happens when the age of the universe becomes equal to the lifetime of P. So when t is equal to the lifetime of p, p decays away, and I go back to radiation. But the point is that the radiation density has fallen off, but because of p decays, I've reheated, and I've come back in, and the temperature at which radiation comes back and becomes the dominant source is called t reheat. So what can happen in this process is these decays of P, remember, I'm assuming that P is very heavy, but I'm also assuming that this decay lifetime is very long. So what can happen is that during the stretch of p domination, your usual dark matter freeze out could have happened. So the usual time at which dark matter froze out could have occurred in this intermediate regime. But if I produce dark matter here, it would have been strongly diluted by the p decays. But what can also happen though is when p decays, p can also decay some of the time into dark matter. So most of the time I'm going to assume that p is decaying into radiation, but p can also decay some fraction of the time into dark matter. So I'm going to write epsilon as a fraction of p decay products that are the dark matter particle, which I'm going to again call pi. And I'll assume that epsilon is much, much less than 1. And that means that 1 minus epsilon is a fraction of the decays that end up as radiation. And the reason this process can be highly non-thermal, and the case in which it's really interesting, is that the non-thermal case corresponds to the situation where my p mass is much, much bigger than my dark matter mass, but my reheating temperature is much, much less than the dark matter freeze-out temperature, which is less than roughly the dark matter mass. So my assumption is going to be that, I'm going to work on under this situation for the most part. So the idea is that I go through this period of p domination, I reheat, and in the reheating process, I produce a density of dark matter particles, even though I'm creating these dark matter particles at a temperature T reheat that's much, much less than the dark matter mass. So in this sense, the process is non-thermal, because thermal processes at temperatures much less than the dark matter mass just don't have enough energy to create the dark matter. So in this sense, this production mechanism is highly non-thermal in this limit. So as far as this goes, we can write a set of differential equations to describe what's going on. And the set of differential equations is pretty straightforward. So my set of differential equations, the first one I can write down is for the energy density in P. And I'll assume that during this whole time, the p's were non-relativistic. So remember that rho p, assuming it's non-relativistic, is just given by this. And this decay width is just 1 over the decay lifetime of the particle. So this is my first equation. My second equation is for radiation. So if I look at the energy density in radiation, it's going to have a piece corresponding to the expansion of the universe. And as far as the radiation goes, the p decays act as a source for radiation. And that means that I get That means that the p decays are going to source radiation in this sense. So this is a fraction of the decays that go to radiation. This is how fast they happen, and this is how much p you have to go into the decay. So this tells me how my radiation evolves. And then finally, I can write a differential equation for the number density of dark matter, which will just be the familiar Boltzmann equation. And in this case, for the Boltzmann equation, I have a source for the Pedicus. Yep.
So in the second equation, why is a factor of 4 there? Because those second terms, they come from the Vici-Vita connection, or?
So the difference between here and here is that in this piece, I'm assuming that the Pedicus pair particle is non-relativistic, whereas radiation is relativistic. So this comes from the equation, effectively the equation of state. The radiation, so because of this 4, radiation redshifts as a to the minus 4. Because of this, matter redshifts as a to the minus 3.
Right.
So it's the difference between the just the way the density redshifts under. So part of the factor is the fact that the energy per, let's say the energy per photon also redshifts with the expansion because the wavelength gets bigger.
Right.
So I get another piece here. And finally, for my dark matter, I get a fraction, I get a source from P. And if I wanted to, I could also put in the contribution that I get from dark matter annihilation. So this is the set of differential equations that describe this process. And actually, one last thing. Remember that in all these equations, h squared, I guess this should be my additional equation, h squared is 8 pi g over 3 times rho p plus rho r plus rho pi. That's just my Hubble equation. So in writing these equations, I've done a little cheat. These equations assume that the number of relativistic degrees of freedom in the universe are constant. But going away from that approximation won't change things too much. So it turns out that these equations are basically identical to the equations you would get for reheating after inflation. So in this case, the way I've drawn things, the P density is coming from the mass density of the particle. In the case of inflation, the energy density, instead of coming from the mass of the inflaton field, comes from the inflaton, the energy of the inflaton field oscillating at its potential. And it turns out that this oscillation energy also redshifts like matter. And the reheating process goes through in basically exactly the same way. So if you like, these equations would also apply to dark matter production after inflation. But in this case, I'm concentrating on the case where P is just matter. OK, so I'm going to have you solve these equations approximately. And I'll let you make some simplifying assumptions in the next homework. But the upshot is that if I look at the solutions in two limits for the dark matter density, it behaves roughly as you expect. So the first case is if I look at the case where T reheat is much, much smaller than T freeze out, the assumption that T reheat is much, much smaller than T freeze out means that this piece is tiny compared to this piece, and I can neglect it. So if I can neglect this piece, I simplify to just this equation. And what I find is that my number density of pi that I produce is roughly given by rho p over mp evaluated at the reheating temperature times epsilon. So in other words, this number density of dark matter I produce is equal to the number density of P, which is just this ratio, evaluated at the reheating temperature. So actually, the way I've written this is confusing. So it's rho p over mp at t equals tv heat times epsilon. And that means that my yield for pi simply goes like tv heat divided by the mass of p times epsilon. So in this case, all the dark matter comes directly from the p decays. And because the effective decays happen after freeze out, there's no reannihilation. On the other hand, if T reheat is much, much greater than T freeze out, what happens is that P decays, and I produce lots of dark matter particles. But the dark matter particles thermalize through this piece. So if the reheating temperature is much larger than T freeze out, this term effectively turns off before this term turns off. And in this case, my my yield for chi is just the usual freeze-out value. And the reason for that is that if I produce all these dark matter particles way before freeze-out, the dark matter scattering interactions have enough time to equilibrate the density of chi's. So in this first situation, this is what we call non-thermal, in that the relative density of dark matter comes from this highly non-thermal process, from this p decay that happens while the thermal bath is not quite in equilibrium. Whereas in this case, this is still thermal dark matter because it's just the usual thermal freeze-out. So if I actually match this story onto inflation, what happens in, the usual story for inflation is your reheating temperature is very, very large compared to the electroweak scale. And if I have wimp dark matter, the story is that even if I produce dark matter particles in the inflaton decays after inflation during reheating, those dark matter particles have enough time to equilibrate with the thermal bath. And I'm back to the situation where I just have a thermal plasma with an equilibrium density of dark matter particles that freezes out in the usual way. On the other hand, if the reheating temperature after inflation is very late, or equivalently, if the reheating temperature after a period of P domination is very late, then I'm in this non-thermal situation, and I get dark matter just from the decays directly. And the annihilation process doesn't make a difference. Okay. So I have 5 more minutes, and in my remaining 5 minutes, I wanted to tell you about one more non-standard way to get the dark matter density. So I'm just going to more or less tell you about how it works and not go into too much detail, but it's been a pretty popular topic in research recently. So I think it's good for you guys to hear about. Okay, and I guess I'm on to example 4. Example 4 is called asymmetric dark matter. Okay, so the idea of asymmetric dark matter is more or less an analogy to the story for baryons. So if I look at baryons in the early universe, baryons just mean things like protons and antiprotons and neutrons and antineutrons. So I'm going to consider temperatures where the quarks and gluons have bound into quarks into protons and neutrons. These protons and antiprotons and neutrons and antineutrons also undergo a freeze-out process. And that freeze-out process is a bit different, though, because I have distinct particles and antiparticles. And baryon number is conserved by your standard model interactions to a very good approximation. So the kind of freeze-out process I can have here, let's say a proton or an antiproton can annihilate, for example, into a pair of photons, or perhaps a pair of gluons that go into pions or something. And the thing is that this annihilation process is very efficient. And I can compute the freeze-out density, assuming equal initial densities of protons and antiprotons, and compare it to the baryon density I would get today. And with equal numbers of protons and antiprotons, and neutrons and antineutrons, what I would predict turns out to be, for the baryon density of the universe today, I would get something on the order of 10 to the minus 10. On the other hand, the observed value is approximately equal to 0.025, I believe. So the thing is that so what we see here is that the observed baryon density can't be understood in terms of a usual thermal freeze-out. And actually, just in passing, this happens at a temperature of about 50 MeV. And this justifies my uses of protons and antiprotons and neutrons and antineutrons. So this observed value of 0.025 is much, much bigger than the 10 to the minus 10. So the question here is, if I look at baryons, how do I get the density that I get? And the answer for baryons is that we have simply more protons and neutrons than antiprotons or antineutrons. And what ends up happening is that this annihilation process, it's still very efficient, the annihilation process uses up all the antiprotons, but it leaves these extra protons behind. And this statement of having more protons than antiprotons is called a baryon asymmetry. So the idea of asymmetric dark matter is I do exactly the same thing. So for asymmetric dark matter, I guess I have to wrap up, but just very quickly, the idea for asymmetric dark matter, or ADM, is now I have distinct chi and anti-chi, and I also have more chi than chi bar. So in other words, I have an asymmetry in the dark matter number densities. And if these chi and chi bars carry conserved charge, this corresponds to a charge asymmetry. And through the same process, the chi anti-chi can annihilate away. And if it's very efficient, all that will be left over is the asymmetry. So that's a very fast idea of asymmetric dark matter. And what people have done is in specific matter, specific examples, is they've related this chi charge to the baryon charge. And when you relate the chi charge to a baryon charge, what you find is the number density of chis you get from the asymmetry is roughly equal to the number density of baryons. And that means that to get omega dark matter h squared to be about 0.1, which is the observed value, this value is going to be equal to m chi over m proton times omega b h squared. So this value is about 1/4. So that means that I want a ratio of the chi mass to the proton mass to be about a factor of 4. And that means that my chi mass ends up being about 5 GeV for this asymmetric dark matter, where I specifically relate the asymmetric dark matter to the baryon density. So there are lots of constructions that realize this, and I won't go into them, but I just wanted to mention how this works in case you run into asymmetric dark matter while you're, let's say, looking through papers or so on. So I think I've gone a bit over, but I guess I'll put it there.